Hour number two here on the Hoffman Show, Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. That hour opener, something from early days of the show. Tuesdays, they're not so bad now, though, because we get to do this.
Today's top story, from the perspective of someone who's there.
You are looking live.
This just in.
Not my beat.
Holy potatoes. This is a little different than the feeling we had last Tuesday. Mitch Tischler with us here on the Hoffman Show. Mitchell, live from Ashburn, presumably ahead of Commander's open locker room in just a few minutes. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing fantastic. Certainly a little bit of a different vibe than last week when we talked. No holy potatoes this week.
No, the potatoes still need to be blessed. Mitchell, yeah. Can I do a big picture thing with you real quick and lean into your TV experience for a moment?
Please.
So my big gripe on the officiating is not necessarily any particular call. I certainly have disagreements, but it is the setup of the specifically the fourth and nine. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry. They're still using chains to measure first downs. There are all kinds of high-definition cameras. There are like 30 of them around the stadium. How they don't have some kind of down-the-line shot that is extraordinarily clear, not to mention some kind of microchip in the ball, is beyond me. For those that don't know in the audience, Mitchell, on top of being the fantastic co-host of the Beltway Football Podcast, has been working in television production for Monumental Sports, NBC Sports Washington, Comcast Sportsnet, whatever it was going by at the time, for a long, long time. He's very well versed in these things, in all kinds of television. So Mitchell, after that giant windup, like, why the hell isn't there a camera that has a very clean shot down the first line, the first down marker? As that's a very important part of the game that is very predictable and seems like there should be a camera there.
Yeah, I mean, listen, different broadcasts have different levels. Just like, you know, you have the broadcast teams, you have production teams that are A, B, C, and D as well. And when you're the A team, you know, you generally get kind of the entire accoutrement of cameras and everything that. That these different networks have, and some of them have the pylon cams that are at the first down marker that look straight across. Unfortunately, the broadcast on Sunday was not utilizing that technology. The league can only use whatever cameras that the broadcast team has on site. And so the review room back in New York gets a raw feed of every camera that they have, as well as the all 22 camera, you know, that they use when, you know, you look at breaking down film or whatever. But the review room can't magically come up with new camera, different camera angles that are looking straight down the line. So ultimately, they get whatever the production crew provides. And typically, the rolling cart that I think folks are familiar with that rolls up and down the sidelines usually is set up around the first down line and gives you more or less that look straight down the line. For whatever reason, and I think probably game time and distance specific, the card wasn't shooting straight down the first down line. And ultimately, the league only could use the video angles that they had. And while I agree with you, I don't think it was a particularly good spot. There was nothing that we saw. And I know folks are going to point to the knee being down and the angle of it that we saw from the 50-yard line. But they had no angle that definitively said that he got the first down there. Now, they could have easily re-spotted it and then marched out the archaic chains to come and do that. Unfortunately, they didn't. They decided not to do that, and I'm not exactly sure what went into that. But the other thing is the technology inside the football that everyone loves to talk about isn't quite as feasible on an NFL field, because that line that you're trying to mark is constantly moving. So there's math and everything else that has to go into, what that would look like, as opposed to soccer and tennis that have, you know, the automatic VAR, you know, and electronic in out of the ball. Those are all set lines. You know, you think about a goal line in soccer, that's always in the same spot. That first down line is moving every single, you know, drive, every single couple of plays. So it's a lot more difficult to implement that sort of technology, but I have no doubt that there's some very smart people out there that are working on it. And the NFL has a lot of money. I'm sure they can figure out a way to get it done.
So that leads to, I guess, my technological follow-up here, which is the broadcast can kind of, I don't say can do whatever it wants. Like, certainly the NFL couldn't, would be pretty ticked off if CBS was just like, hey guys, we're gonna shoot this one on a $100 budget, so you get what you get. Like, that's not gonna fly. But couldn't the league install cameras? Like, and you know, they've got like the second spectrum system, whatever the hell they call it in the NBA, where they track all 10 players and the ball at all times with pretty exacting accuracy. And it's more of like a dot system than it is actual film. But they have a way to then turn that into some kind of readout that they can see and really, you know, pretty precise spacing on. So maybe there's a version of that. But also just, again, on like the pure video side of it, like, how hard would it be on that rolling cart to say, you can have a camera that swivels on top of that thing, but we're also going to mount one to the cart. It's going to be exactly at the first down line, and it's going to shoot straight. And that way, if we ever need that, we have it. Like, why, or could the league dictate that? And why, if they have billions of dollars, wouldn't they?
So, I mean, the cart is run by the production, not run by the league. And if you want to get into, should the league mandate that every game is produced and shot and created the same way so that every game has equal camera angles and equal camera operators and, you know, all those different things, you're getting into a little bit of a different horse, I would say, there. But as far as the cart goes, you know, I don't know how much you've watched the carts, but there's literally a guy who's driving it up and down the sideline. There's no yard markers or, you know, there's no, you know, pylons for them to make sure that they pull up directly, exactly at the line of scrimmage, just shoot straight down it. It's, you know, it's a human operated, you know, mechanism. So I think that there needs to be, you know, the next step in terms of this, you know, review that the league is doing. And I think you can, you know, look at kind of the progression over the years where there was no reviews that were being done at all. It was just whatever the refs called on. You know, then you have a couple red flags you can call for certain things. Now this year, the league is automatically looking at certain calls and plays, and they're, you know, calling down to the refs on the field to correct, you know, obvious mistakes that have happened. And I think the next step is probably the ball technology to find a way to track it. I know you mentioned the NBA version of it. You know, Next Gen Sports has the dots that we all look at, you know, after some plays, and they do track, you know, all 22 players on the field as well as the football. But we're talking about the need for that tracking to be an exact science, not a, you know, it's generally around the 45 yard line, because that's where the difference is between, you know, basketball to some extent and football. If you put the tracker in the middle of the football and it generally is aware of where it is on the field, you kind of can get a general feel, but it's not an exact science to it. I think it's coming. I think that as much as it's frustrating for us to watch a game and recognize that there's all this technology out there and it's not being applied to the sport that we're watching is frustrating. The Commanders aren't the first fan base, aren't the first team to feel like they got the short end of the stick on a mark or a, you know, a bad call by an official. And I think we're seeing, you know, kind of the process of where the NFL started to kind of where they want to get to as far as reviews go. And we're kind of right in the middle of that time-space continuum.
Yeah, no, I think that's well put. And to be clear on my point, I know a lot of fans are obviously upset specifically about the Ertz call. My larger point is, like, for a multi-billion dollar operation, this is just not good enough across the board, because the human beings in the stripes, they missed the spot. They also missed a hold on TJ Watt in the end zone. So, you know, it tends to come out bad calls each way in the wash, but I would just like less bad calls overall. They have too much money to not figure it out, and it's kind of the most important thing, which is the game itself. Mitch Tischler with us. That'll conclude Tech Talk with Mitch Tischler. Let's get to Mitch's other favorite topic. Offensive line play. Brandon Coleman did not have a good game on Sunday, Mitchell, but how much, like, when you watch that, him and that performance, it is his second career, like, full start, if you will, without the rotation with Lucas. What did you take out of that performance that either does or does not concern you moving forward?
I don't know that I would say that he didn't perform well. I think there were spots that he didn't perform particularly well. But I think as a whole, the fact that you can look at kind of the edge rushers for the Steelers, again, as a whole, because I think it's only fair to, as you evaluate Brandon Coleman, who was left on an island a lot in that game because of the fact that Wiley was out and Trent Scott was on the right side. So they were sent, and obviously TJ Watt is over there as well. They sent a lot of help that direction, and you could tell that, you know, TJ Watt was relatively quiet the entire game until the last, you know, minute and a half, 2 minutes of the game when the Commanders were trying to make that, you know, that game winning drive there. I thought that the Andrew Wiley being out as well as Cornelius Lucas being out kind of affected the entire pass blocking scheme. And honestly, the ability of Cliff Kingsbury to do some of the things that he wanted to do, because you know, you have, you know, all world defensive end over there on one side against a backup tackle who, you know, I think at least those of us that have watched him in training camp and in the preseason recognize that there's some limits to what Trent Scott can do versus, you know, some of the other guys, forced them to switch up kind of how they were going to protect Jaden Daniels. And ultimately, that ended up leaving Brandon Coleman solo, you know, against, you know, some of the best pass rushers in the NFL. And I think he did a pretty good job for the most part in pass pro, except for when he did get beat. And we said this about Andrew Wiley a lot. When he got beat real clean and real quick, and Jaden had no opportunity after that. So I think, you know, as much as this season, the learning curve for, you know, Jaden Daniels, and we break down kind of his play day to day, practice to practice, game to game, I think it's the same for Brandon Coleman, who, you know, just last week was the first time that he started and played an entire NFL game, you know, solo. So he's also in this learning curve, this learning situation. And I think, you know, part of that is there's going to be some bumps, particularly, you know, when you are talking about a third round tackle out there. But I don't know that I'm as concerned, which might, I'm not trying to take any shots at the Eagles by any means, but I'm not quite as concerned about the edge rushers that the Eagles are going to be running out there as opposed to Highsmith and Watt from Pittsburgh. I think they're in a level of their own, the league of their own.
Yeah, I totally agree with that part. And I think the point about losing cleanly, losing quickly, and he had a couple missed assignments too. There's one I remember specifically that he gave up a sack, and Biotis just goes over and just lets him have it. Yeah. He's like, what are we doing, man? But that's also like the terrible part about playing offensive line is if you play 60 snaps and 55 of them are excellent, and five of them you'll lose. Like percentage wise, it's pretty good. But if you give up five quick, clean losses, like that's a really bad day at the office. The threshold is so high. I think the other big thing about the offensive line is what was their role slash I say the line play. Pittsburgh good, Washington whatever superlative or adjective you want to use here, about the limits on Jaden as a runner. Was there something that Washington you think could have done differently in the way they block things up, or did Jaden have done differently, and do you have any concerns about other teams being able to bottle him up like Pittsburgh did?
Yeah, I mean, I think teams are going to have made a concerted effort to bottle up Jaden in the run game. I think the Steelers had Patrick Queen, who is a rare linebacker that has the speed to kind of get to the edge similarly to what Jaden Daniels does. And they had him doing a lot of spying on Jaden. And, you know, particularly in the run game, there wasn't a whole lot of room for him to move because Patrick Queen was able to get to the edges and set it and force him back inside. I also think, you know, you mentioned Biotis and, you know, that injury that he picked up during the game, or whether it's been lingering or not, I think was a big factor in the ability to run the ball kind of overall, because the interior of that O-line, which has been such a strength, I thought struggled at times last Sunday. And, you know, when I look ahead to what the Eagles are going to have, you know, Jordan Davis and the other kid, Jalen Carter,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those are two young, you know, big, athletic, strong, athletic again, interior D linemen who can wreck an offense altogether. And, you know, I also think the lack of having Brian Robinson is pretty major. And I think, you know, the two games that we've seen against Baltimore and against Pittsburgh where he wasn't able to play, it wasn't just Jaden couldn't get the run game going. The entire offense couldn't get the run game going. And, you know, I asked around in the building and to some of the coaches about, you know, obviously when you are missing your top running back, how much does that affect the rest of the run game? You know, but did you expect it to be, you know, they've averaged almost 170 yards a game with Brian Robinson, and that's total rushing by anyone that's carrying the football in games that he's in. And I think they're around 75 yards a game or so in games that he's not in. And that's a huge problem. And, you know, obviously the number is going to go down when you're starting running backs out. But I think the threat of Brian Robinson really has hurt Jaden Daniels' ability to kind of get to the edges, because teams don't have to, you know, worry about having a bowling ball in there going to, you know, pull you around for 5, 6, 7 yards at a time like Brian Robinson does. And ultimately, you know, I think that's something that Cliff and DQ and kind of Adam Lynn and Bobby Johnson, everyone who's involved in the run game, they need to wrap their head around, you know, kind of trying to find a fix for the non-Brian Robinson games, because he didn't practice today, and I would say he's probably going to carry at least a questionable designation into Thursday night. That's going to be something that that they have to figure out.
It definitely is. I was very surprised to not see more of Chris Rodriguez. Some of it is bad reads, but a lot of it is just not, like, the results and the way that, or I should say the looks that they're getting to run into are just different. The way that B-Rob affects things. The zone read game, like, Pittsburgh was like, please hand it to the running back. Do not let Jaden run. And the way they did that, I thought was spectacular. And then, you know, obviously Wiley, like, he's a very good run blocker. So it's going to be interesting to see what they can do against Philly. Last thing for you, Mitch, the secondary. Everyone knows that there's issues back there. That's why they traded for Marshon Lattimore. Correctly identifying the issues, I think, is a little more, you know, it's a little bit more difficult. I think that down in, down out, St. Juice is their best corner. I also fully acknowledge that in big situations, it seems like he does not perform up to the level that he does on the rest of those downs to earn that designation in the first place. If we can at least agree on that, that sets us up here. What do they do with that information, both Thursday if there's no Lattimore, and then long-term, what do you do with that information?
I mean, Thursday, if Lattimore is not able to go, then as much as Commanders fans are going to be frustrated by it, I don't know that there's that much else that they can really change to. But they have a short cornerback room as is, and not height-wise, just in terms of depth there. And if you don't go with St. Juice, then you're giving a lot more reps to Emmanuel Forbes or to Michael Davis, I guess. But I think, you know, early on in the season, they tried the Michael Davis experiment in terms of, you know, being out there a fair amount and got their answer as to, you know, his value is on special teams and, you know, as a spot player in the secondary. There's just not a lot of answers outside of St. Juice. And when Lattimore is able to go and be a big part of this, I think that's when the real question comes for this coaching staff, because there's a very real situation that I look at where you have Marshon Lattimore on the outside on one side, Mikey Sanders still on the outside on another, and I would go with Noah Igbinoghene as a slot corner with St. Juice, you know, rotating in from time to time. But, you know, I think what you said should carry a lot of weight, and fans don't want to hear it because, you know, in the moment when the big play happens, you know, you're frustrated, and it seems every time that that's BSJ, that's the one that's, you know, getting beat on it. But he is who he is as a corner, and I think you need to adjust coverages so that he's not being left one-on-one in big situations. Make sure that he has the safety help over top. You know, on 3rd and 9 there, I don't know why you're not playing, you know, some too deep, some too high there, and, you know, making sure that you protect the first down line, which is obviously something that is very important and need to do on a 3rd and 9 like that. But you're also up in the football game. You got to make sure that you keep the lead. So, you know, you can't get beat over top there in that situation. Part of it certainly is lack of, I would say whatever issue BS Benjamin St. Jude showed on that play. But I think the scheme also didn't do him any favors.
Yeah, I struggle with that one a lot. And I asked Dan about it after the game, and I talked about it for a while with Logan this morning before we started recording, and then we talked about it a little bit on the pod too. But, like, coaches will tell you, hey, so sometimes we got to take our shots. And talking about, like, we got to man up on the outside and we got to bring pressure. And I kind of am at the point where I'm like, do you? Like, why? And you go back through the game, and you go, you want to know what? They did get a lot of bad Russ throws against pressure where he launches the moon ball and it goes out of bounds, or it's an easy incompletion, and you know that it limits the options and all of that stuff. But I just tend to agree with you that based off the time, the score, the situation, and the opponent, you know if you can make Russ think he's got to get rid of it, he's going to throw a moon ball. And to be honest, the quality of the moon ball that he threw, maybe a safety over the top doesn't even help because it's so close to the sideline. But I'd rather him be staring at a defender over the top, hey, this is zone, my deep stuff is dead, and have to figure out something underneath, 3rd and 9 with 2.5 minutes to go. And even if they get 4 yards and then convert a 4th and 5 or get 10 yards on a slant and keep driving, you don't go behind in the football game. And so, I don't know. I keep doing circles on this, Mitch, because their pressure package is who they want to be, and it isn't a bad option with guys like Luvu flying off the edge. But I also just kind of go, there's a gap between who you want to be and who you are, and you have to coach sometimes to who you are.
Yeah, and listen, we've talked a lot about, complementary football, offense, defense, special teams, all that. There's also complementary football within a side of the football. And when you're bringing a blitz, which is why they were in single high and why Benjamin St. Juice is left, on an island one-on-one, to me, it makes sense that the corners are up on your wide receiver and jamming him so that there's not an easy throw for, the quarterback to make in that situation. I almost feel like when they play this 10 yard break between the wide receiver and corner, the corners are almost relaxed at 10 yards off because they think the blitz is going to be able to get to them, and the play is definitely going to have to be thrown in front of them, which is probably why Benjamin St. Juice kind of got frozen on the first down line there, because there's a blitz coming. He thinks that they're going to force Russ into a quick throw, which ultimately means probably a slant, a hitch, a out, something quick to his side of the ball. And the fact that he's playing so far back, I think he got a little – he was resting on his laurels a little bit, whereas if he's up on a receiver jamming him, maybe Mike Williams doesn't get a clean break off the line, and maybe Russ has to think going somewhere else because he's getting jammed at the line of scrimmage. I think that, like you said, theoretically, there are a lot of things that Joe Witt does that I like, and I think that a lot of it makes sense. This is the one thing that I've seen this season, since the start of the year that's kind of been percolating and questioning in my mind, is when they bring blitzes and have their corners off of the wide receivers, it feels like they're almost allowing quick completions to happen or allowing guys to get open looks, where I'd rather, if you're pressure across the front, hopefully not somebody off their route, don't let Mike Williams have a clean release and be able to just run right by a corner that's standing 10 yards down the field.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know, sometimes I'm just like, this makes sense, but coaches tell you that that's not how you should do it. And I'm like, I don't know. They're the professionals. They're really smart, but maybe I'm missing something. But you and I, Mitch, if I'm on the same page with you, I'm having a good Tuesday. So I'll take it, man. I'll take it.
I got to be honest. I feel the same way. But listen, I think that when Marshon Lattimore is able to play, I think you're going to see Joe Witt be able to call the type of defense that he wants to call, because he's talked about, Jimmy's and Joe's, not X's and O's. And as much as that's true, making sure the right players are touching the football and on the field at the right time, you gotta, if you're a complex defensive coordinator, you gotta be able to make your calls as you want them. And I think Marshon Lattimore will allow that to happen. Yeah.
Let's replace Jimmy and Joe with Marshon, and I think that'll be better. Mitch Tischler, everybody, you can listen to him on the Beltway Football Podcast with JP Finley, which is also live after games on the Monumental Sports app. Are y'all going live from Philly at 1 o'clock in the morning or whenever it will be? You doing it?
We will be live after the game in Philadelphia on Thursday. We're hoping to hit around 12:15, I think.
Okay.
We'll do a half hour, 45-minute postgame show. It'll be fun.
Well, I give you the full-throated endorsement of everyone watch that on the Monumental Sports app. And then the next morning when Logan and I, who will be sleeping at that, Logan will be coming back from the game. I will be sleeping at that time. You can watch the instant, in quotes, reaction show from Take Command on Friday. Mitch, thanks as always for your time, and we'll talk to you next week.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
All right. That's Mitch Tischler, everybody. When we get back here on the Hoffman Show, speaking of Logan Paulson, our Jaden Daniels Tape Tuesday breakdown is next.
It's time for a Take Command Tape Tuesday.
Jaden Daniels just lays it out there perfectly. What a throw.
On the Hoffman Show.
I think the first thing that we should talk about before we get to the passing game, and there's missed throws, there's drops, there's all that kind of stuff, is Jaden Daniels has been incredible as a scrambler and as a runner in general this year. Pittsburgh completely shut that down. How did they do it?
I mean, they had a great plan. I think you see their awareness of what he is and what he can do. I mean, every single time there's times where he's just doing like a handoff and he's like a token zone read fake. Like there's no blocking to support the zone read. And TJ Watt is like basically tackling him. You know what I mean? Like it's like he's not tackling him, but he's going to hit him. He's going to wrap him up. And I just thought they were like, you're not going to do this. And there is some psychology to this. Jeez, there we go. To kind of get the quarterback to be like, I don't want to do this. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to pull it because they're so aware of that I've got it. So I think back to the Pittsburgh 49ers Super Bowl, right? Which was, Baltimore 49ers Super Bowl a couple years ago. A couple years ago now, it was probably like 2013 or 12. And Colin Kaepernick was lighting the NFL on fire with the quarterback run stuff. And Baltimore was basically like, you know what we're going to do? Every single time he does it, we're going to hit him because he's a runner. Like that's the designation in the rule. Like you are a runner, right. We can hit you. And basically like it just killed that element of their offense. And I felt like they weren't that physical with Jaden, the level that they were with Colin Kaepernick back in 12 or whatever that was. But they were incredibly aware and they were very, very like, we're going to grab you. We're going to make you think about it. We're going to, you know, we want you to know that we know that you're thinking about doing this and we don't want you to do it. And so there's a couple times where that awareness hurt them. Like Austin Ekeler had a 10-yard run where Highsmith is beelining to him and he hands it off and Eckler's able to cut it back kind of in the zone that he's vacated. But I do think that to me is kind of the main thing is they were just like, we're not going to let you do what you want to do. And that and sometimes that's all it takes is just like the defensive coordinator showing Cliff that, hey, don't do this unless you want to get your quarterback a shot to the ribs. And I know he's a little bit banged up. And I think that's to me what it felt like.
Yeah, it almost felt like, hey, if you're an edge player and you're unblocked, whether it's true zone read or fake zone read, you go to the quarterback. If you sense you're unblocked, do not worry about a read. Your read is go, and we will take care of the front side. And that's where Deshaun Elliott and Patrick Queen and all these guys that have so much speed, and obviously Cam Hayward and the eating of the blocks and Keanu Benton and on down the list. These guys are so good that they can stop the run without the extra player. And so, yeah, technically you have the numbers if you're Washington, but it's like just don't let him pull the backside and get the 40-yarder. We don't want him to get out on the edge. And I think the other thing, though, is from a scrambling standpoint, was there anything particular that they did where he also wasn't able to escape the pocket and pick up, you know, some of the first downs and things with his legs that we've seen keep this offense on schedule all year long?
Yeah, I think this is a good case study in showing how to rush well with four and rush well with five and the importance of compressing the pocket. Because people always talk, oh, well, quick wins and unabated to the rusher. And like when you're doing defensive line stuff, you're like, oh my gosh, look at this rush. But there's a lot of value, especially internally, if you can get quick power on a guard and collapse that pocket, right? Because like one of the things that they did a good job of was Cam Hayward's getting long arms on guys and the pocket just, there's no running lane. It just perfectly compresses around him. It's almost like it's like a noose tightening around him. So the only way he can vacate is if he goes deep. And we talked about this in the pregame show, but basically like that's where TJ Watt hunts, right? That's, he's the shark. That's the deep water. So you could tell Jaden's like, I don't really want to be back there. So let me try to step up. And there's no space. And there's a couple times where it looked like there was space, but they did a great job because we talked about the five man rushes where they're stunting the two defensive tackles. He's getting pressure here, like to his left. Right. And then they loop a linebacker around and then he's just right in that hole vacated by the defensive line. So they just, in terms of disciplined power rushes from the interior of that group, it was excellent. And so on the sideline, you're like, because usually he does a great job getting back there. He can kind of find a little grass and then scoot out. But you could just tell that group was like a well-oiled machine in terms of being like, nope. It wasn't like they spied. It just, like, it's a thing that like Ron used to talk about all the time. Like, hey, we need to rush together. We need to rush as four. And it never kind of happened to me.
Easy to say, hard to do.
Yeah. And to me, this was just like, you want to like clinic tape on how to do it? Like, these guys are going to be selfless. They're going to bowl these guys back. They're not trying to get sacks. Like, credit to Cam Hayward and Cano Benton, because like, there's times where you could win quick, but I know I got to power this thing in and again, constrict that sucker up. And it was a lot of fun. That was fun for me to watch because it's like football nerdy stuff. But to me, that's the reason that he couldn't scramble, is because they were just so aware and they were so, even TJ, to his credit, like usually he's ripping the edge all the time, really working. He was so disciplined with his position. Highsmith was incredibly disciplined. And so really credit to that group, because they came in, they knew where he could hurt you, and they said, you're not going to do that to us.
And yet, there were so many opportunities.
So many ops. Yeah.
From a passing game standpoint, obviously some of the throws downfield to Terry, he was not afraid of Joey Porter Jr. You want a corner who actually had a bad game? Joey Porter Jr. got torched left, right, and sideways, specifically by Terry McLaurin and Noah Brown. But obviously there's some stuff left on the field. What do you make of how Jaden performed as a passer, both from a decision-making and an accuracy standpoint?
Yeah, I actually thought he made good decisions. There was one early in the game that was a little bit tough, but it was like this sick look, you know, like when you see cool stuff, teams run this all the time, but basically, like, you know, Tampa 2, they got that Mike linebacker that runs out of there, right?
Yeah.
And so what they did is Tampa did a really cool coverage thing. They kind of had the safety sitting in a two shell structure. They got the Mike linebacker, who was the safety in this case, dropping like it's Tampa 2. And then it actually inverts and rotates to cover 3. And so Jaden is getting ready to throw this ball like it's cover 2. It's the one that is behind Noah Brown early in the game. I think everyone's like, well, that's a bad miss. That's a bad miss. To me, it felt like versus Tampa 2, that's where the ball should go. And then it's like, oh, damn, this is actually cover 3. And those are hook players. And Micah Fitzpatrick is about to pick this ball off. Let me get this to the back shoulder of Noah Brown real quick. So, like, even that recognition in that short time is pretty cool, and a really sick disguise there, honestly, by Pittsburgh. But I just, the one thing I will say is he felt a little off from an accuracy standpoint, just a little bit. And there was a couple times where that pocket's compressing around him, specifically on the one to OZ, where he's kind of crossing the field. They're running like what I would call like a knife concept off a pop pass action. So they pull the guard. He's got a man beater. He's coming across the field. It kind of plays like pop pass, but the combination is knife. So through and then a dig behind it. And he does a great job kind of stepping, avoiding a little bit of a rush. His base is a little bit off. So the thing about Jaden to me is he's always able to get to a good base, but if he's not balanced in the base, sometimes the ball will just tail ever so slightly. So he kind of does a quick shuffle. His base is pretty good, but as he throws it, he kind of opens his hips and falls away a little bit because the rush is coming. And the ball is got great velocity. It's got great spin. It just kind of tails just ever so slightly to the left. And OZ is running to space, but it's got a little bit too much juice on it. It's tailing a little bit too much, and he just can't get there. And so that's a play where, and that happened probably, I'd say 5 times, where the rush just got a little bit tight. The ball comes out a little bit too fast, and we missed the throw. So,
yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was something that I thought during the game as well. And part of the kind of he was sped up was he was firing fastballs. Yeah. All over the place. And I thought his decision making was mostly really good. Like, there's not a lot of times where I'm like, oh, he missed a bunch of this, or and there's like one or two where he's got opportunities that he maybe could have thrown something bigger or whatever. But like, that's every single quarterback game that we've ever watched. He mostly is going the right place with the football, but the accuracy is a little bit off. And sometimes it was just purely the velocity. And like that knife to OZ, like, just put that sucker out there where he can go catch it. Not like it's like a 10-yard pass. So it's not like you're lobbing it, you know, Russell Wilson moonball, but like just lay it out there, let him run under it. You don't need to fire it on his body as he's running across the field. Obviously the drop by Diami in the end zone is a horrendous drop. It hits him. You can't hit him between the numbers because he wears number 2, but you hit him in the chest. But that also, like, that was a laser beam. And it probably didn't have to be. And there's a couple of others as well where it just feels like he mentally was going, I gotta get the ball out now. And just chucks it. And I think some of the drops were that too, where his touch has been so impeccable all year long. And between the accuracy and the touch, some of the incompletions started to stack up in a way that they just haven't this year. And again, the decision-making is good. I don't think that is like a long-term problem. It was the best defense he's probably faced all year. The pocket's getting constricted. But I think that's such a astute observation, and the speeding up of it, and how it manifests is like, sometimes it's just like, if you take the same decision, the same throw, and slow your arm down a half a second, you probably have a completion there.
And it, to me, it's like he's got such a nice compact release. It was just like how he was flicking it. Like you said, like it's like I'm away from the rush and I was just a little bit too juiced. Even the one to Luke late in the game that we talked about that he kind of missed deep. Like brilliant decision. Way to buy a little time. Like, great job. But like, you've done such a good job, to your point, of like just putting a little feather on it, right? Just a little feather on it. Cause the one thing that that does allow you to do is it limits the need for pinpoint accuracy, right?
Right.
Cause these are the best receivers in the world. They can adjust to that football now. Even the one OZ, if I put a little touch on it, he can take a different angle. He can adjust to that ball and make that catch. Same thing with Luke. It's a little bit of touch. Like, I can make it happen for you. And again, he makes a great throw to Terry. He did some really nice stuff, tight window stuff to Noah Brown. You know, like, there's some good stuff in there, but there was just a little bit of, and to me, I think it's reflective of kind of the whole offense. And, you know, maybe he's such a big part of the offense, that's why you feel it. But, you know, like the one to Zach, like, great throw to Zach over the middle field. And Zach, again, right in the chest and drops it. And so there was a couple of those where you're like, damn. Like, and the one to Luke on the sideline, we just talked about that. Again, is that a tough catch? But is that a play that I've seen him make in practice like 30 times? Like,
and it's also a throw that Jaden typically makes. Like, it's a drop by Luke, so I'm not trying to shift blame. But also, like, that ball's a little bit late and inside.
Yeah.
And if it's a little bit more outside, it's obviously, I mean, you would know that it's a much easier catch going on an out when you can get to keep going out versus trying to slow your body and come back inside to it. So, like, those are the kinds of throws that he's made pretty perfectly all year, which is why his completion percentage is outrageous. It's like 70%+. He's had the 80s, the Cincinnati game where he's in the 90s. Like, he's been so unbelievably perfect all year that he finally got sped up a little bit, and he still has a pretty good game because, as you said, like the throw on the sideline, I mean, we saw some of the best deep balls that you'll see all year in this game between Russ and Jaden, the deep ball on the sideline to Terry. Like, that was sick. You know, he hits that RPO to Terry on the slant to start the second half. Like, that's a perfect ball. So he has plenty of fantastic stuff in this game, but it just, the constriction, everything gets a little bit tighter and sped up, and then you get a couple more incompletions than you're used to. And again, in a 1-point game, everything matters. A couple more of those, and perhaps this thing is a little bit different. Anything else to wrap up here, Logan?
No, I'm really excited for the preview on Wednesday, and I'm excited for this game, man. I'm really, really excited because, like, how do you bounce back from something like this? And I can't wait to see. Because, again, I think they're going to be kicking themselves when they watch this film. Like, man, defensively, we're 5 plays away. Offensively, we're 10 plays away. Like, that are plays that we can make, you know? And I think that's the thing that really sticks out to me. You know, it's just like, man. And hopefully they take that, they're motivated, and they get after it going into this Philly game.
Want more from Craig and Logan? Subscribe now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. More Hoffman Show next on the Team 980 and the free Odyssey app.
It's Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980. We're always live as well on the free Odyssey app. Pick 6 at 6. You hear from Dan Quinn and Jaden Daniels coming up in 9 minutes. And then at 6:30 tonight, typically at 6 o'clock on Tuesdays, we do our NFL tiers. You got those at 6:30 because DQ and Jaden spoke today with a short week. So we're a little scrambled this week, but we'll make sense of it all. It'll all be good. Right now, though, we're going to talk about a different team in the NFL, one that fired their offensive coordinator today. That is Caleb Williams' Chicago Bears. Shane Waldron's like, sick, I get to coach a generational quarterback prospect. And then he did a bunch of really ridiculous stuff with said quarterback prospect, and now he's fired, Anthony. This had to happen. And again, the idea that we're talking about coaches needing to get fired or rooting for people to lose their jobs, like, it's not rooting for it. It's just the reality of the situation. Like, he did a bad job, and he did a fireable job. And apparently, you have players going to Matt Eberflus, vets, saying, can you please make a change at offensive coordinator? And can Tyson Bagent start instead of Caleb Williams? So things are mega sideways in Chicago. I think you probably start with just the OC, but who knows if Caleb is going to be... The thing is, like, if you're at Flus and you bench Caleb, you're not coming back next year. Like, unless you make the playoffs this year with Caleb Williams, no GM or owner in their right mind would let you continue. Even if you go like, well, hey, I'll make a different hire at offensive coordinator. Okay, sorry, we're not going to let you make any more hires. You screwed up the last one so badly. And I realize that you probably don't want to make all the changes right now. And the defensive guys, I think, guess have enough respect for Flus that you don't make the change at the head coaching spot. And their defense until the last couple weeks was obviously pretty good. But like the ways they've used DJ Moore, mind-bending. The ways they use Rome Odunze, the ways they use Keenan Allen, the throws they ask and the amount that they ask Caleb Williams to do. Like, it's just a disaster. And I don't need to bore everybody with the details of Chicago Bears stuff, but like some of the national podcasts that I listen to that get into that kind of stuff, especially the Athletic Football Show, because Robert Mays, the host, is a Chicago guy and a big Bears fan. Like, the disgust that Robert has when talking about that offense, the team that he roots for, because he knows how badly it's being done. It would be funny if Robert wasn't my friend and I wanted him to be having a better life and existence as a football fan. But to do it with a number one overall pick who's a generational type of guy and just be ruining him, especially when, you know, you look over what's happening here in D.C. and you have a guy that you could have potentially hired in Cliff Kingsbury and he is doing the best job that we've arguably ever seen with a rookie quarterback, then it becomes pretty hard to swallow, I think, if you're a Bears fan. And it makes today, I mean, it's not a good day because you never want to be here, but like, thank God that's over.
Yeah, I'm so thankful we're not in a situation like that. But it does also suck to see how in Chicago relationships with the quarterback, the rookie quarterbacks, is so just shattered over there. And it's not the first time like we've seen this. I think last year with Bryce Young, we sort of kind of saw that. And maybe that, this is what I'll say. I think when it comes to rookie quarterbacks and throwing the guys into the fire, some guys aren't ready for it. And it's not necessarily some guys aren't ready for it. I don't think some offensive coordinators are necessarily ready for it just because you're not dealing with your prototypical, you know, 4 or 5 year NFL starting quarterback. You're dealing with somebody that's coming from the college ranks and they need time to develop into something. You know, we started out quick game, running the ball, and like,
They also didn't give everything to Jaden.
Yeah.
Like, they anointed Caleb. Uh-huh. Like, no kidding, he's the guy.
Yeah.
Play the game. And for everyone who got mad at Dan Quinn for playing the game, for making Jaden compete, even though he was just going to crush Marcus Mariota.
Yep.
Like, this is why you do it. Would Caleb have beaten out Tyson Bagent? Probably. He's Tyson Bagent. All due respect. Like, a very solid backup in the league.
Mm-hmm.
A guy who's got an incredible story. D2 guy, all that. Jazz, but like, you should have made him compete, especially for a guy that is as well respected as Bagent is, because then it's a lot easier for guys to buy in, as opposed to like, oh, Caleb is getting all the love on Hard Knocks, he's got the one-on-one meetings with the head coach, he's anointed the starter from day one. It's like, hey, we just want him to come in and learn the playbook, like one thing at a time. And instead it's like, hey, we want you to be the franchise savior, go do it. And for a guy whose play style is be the savior on every play, that seems like a very silly thing to do. Like, I'd be trying to put the reins on him before taking them off. And by the way, he's also younger. Yep. Like, Caleb was here in the DMV playing high school ball not that long ago. Jaden Daniels played with Brandon Ayuk at Arizona State. Like, we're talking about, it's 2 years of an age gap, a year and a half, 2 years, but like, that's a pretty significant age gap and experience gap in terms of games started in college. And so I think what you're seeing is some of these guys that can come in and do stuff immediately have a little bit more experience or a little bit older. Stroud's the exception. Like, he's a young guy. So there really are no hard, steadfast rules.
Exactly.
Except for, don't put too much on the kid's plate. Stroud, they built this like Sean McVay style, Kyle Shanahan style running game with Bobby Slowick and the play action game off of it. And they asked Stroud to do the stuff he was good at. And he was awesome. Caleb, they're like, hey, go be the superhero guy you were at USC. Oh, you mean when we lost a bunch of games and I threw too many picks and I was running for my life all the time? Yeah! And that's who he's been in the pros, instead of a guy who you could have probably put in a small box, let his talent shine, and brought him along until he eventually turned into that guy. The interesting thing is Thomas Brown is now going to be the OC there. He is off the McVay tree. He also was with Bryce Young in Carolina, so yikes. But can he, you know, obviously he was running Frank Reich stuff down there. Can he be the guy that creates a much more stable environment for Chicago and Caleb and gets that thing turned around? Basically impossible in the middle of a season, but we'll see what they can do. It's Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. When we get back to the Commanders and our pick six at 6:00.